Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
It's Thursday, April 11th, and your Ben Jarofsky Show starts right now. On today's program, Ben's talking with Ace Attorney and podcaster Jim Coogan. The Ben Jarofsky Show, a presentation of the Chicago Reader. ChicagoReader.com for everything there is to know in the city of Chicago. If you want to know what to do, where to go, what to eat, what to drink, you want to keep updated on news, politics in the city of Chicago, well, you can head to ChicagoReader.com and you can get your tickets for the Best of Chicago event happening real soon at the zoo. And if you want more Ben Jarofsky, head to ChicagoReader.com/Jarofsky. That's J-O-R-A-V as in victory, S-K-Y.
Hello again, everybody. Ben Jarofsky here. We're calling this OJ's Gift to Trump Thursday, and here's why. Oh, man, Ace Attorney Jim Coogan is on deck, and we had planned, ladies and gentlemen. We had sketched out over a delicious breakfast at Early Morning Delight yesterday, a pre-show breakfast gathering. What we were going to do today, talk about Trump's travails, his legal travails. And then I wake up this morning and learn OJ died. And then I read this unbelievably fascinating article in the New York Times. Yes, I know I've been trashing their political coverage, but I got to give them credit. This wasn't completely worthless. And I've since subsequently sent it to every single guest who's going to be coming to my show to talk politics for the next week as homework. And I always tell them, you don't have to read the whole article. Just read half the article about allies of Trump plan to bolster third party runs. Fascinating story of political chessmanship that's going on with the Republican Party right now as they're trying to maneuver to get Trump to be victorious by promoting third party candidates to dissatisfied Democrats in order. Every vote counts. Every vote absolutely counts. This is how they figured it out. They've locked in MAGA. MAGA's theirs. They got MAGA. So whether you're, you know, the Monroe says 40%, I say 45%, whatever. It's locked in, baked in. They've got it. Then there's like the going to vote for Biden no matter what crowd. I'm kind of in that. I'm in that crowd. Okay. Then there's everybody like dissatisfied leftists. The lefties aren't going to vote for Biden. We all know that. But Muslim voters, Arab American voters, young voters, just everybody who just doesn't like Biden for whatever. Joe Rogan voters who just don't like Biden. So maybe they're not going to vote Trump because Trump is so despicable, but they may vote for Bobby Kennedy, baby Bobby. And so there's an effort being made by the Trump people, which is not unlike what Pritzker did, to follow me in this. They get air commercials talking about what a dangerous radical lefty baby Bobby is. This is straight up Pritzker did the same thing, man. So they air these commercials to say what a dangerous leftist baby Bobby is, and then like dissatisfied leftists, our young voter, right? They just consider this person completely and totally clueless. Go, oh, I'll vote for baby Bobby because a Donald Trump backed commercial tells me he's a dangerous leftist. If I saw it on TV, it must be true. Because, you know, so everything is predicated on the voters being complete idiots. We understand that. Very effective, very intricate game of political chess. And this one is the most diabolically cynical of them all. This one right here. So they're going to take out ads in newspapers in areas of Michigan where there's a high concentration of Arab Americans. Follow me in this, folks. And they'll take out ads and papers thanking Joe Biden for standing by Israel. Thanking Joe Biden for standing by Israel in order to fire up Arab American voters against Biden because he's quote unquote stood with Israel. Meanwhile, Trump himself is going around saying any Jew who votes for Biden is a traitor to his religion. This has got to be the most cynical ploy. I don't know. I think I've ever seen in politics. And I followed Chicago politics, folks. I know all the games that Rahm Emanuel played to successfully convince most of you to vote for him in 2015 when he put that sweater on and all you guys, oh, God, he's wearing a sweater. So I understand how I understand the cynical games that politicians play. But this one, taking the ad out in newspapers in areas where a lot of Arab Americans live in Detroit or suburban Detroit, saying, thank you, Biden, for standing with Israel, and then saying, any Jew who votes for Biden is a traitor to his religion. Wow. Whew. I better strap on my seatbelt because this is going to be a rocky road to the finish. All right. I'm going to put aside politics for the moment, although I don't know. Jim Coogan likes to go down that political path every now and then. We'll get to the Trump trials in a bit. But first of all, welcome back, Jim. It's good to see your smiling face, even if it's over a screen.
It's always great to be here, Ben. Thank you.
And we will not talk about our beloved White Sox. Something I just saw in the paper today, Jim, another injury. But I do want to, I actually want to get your thoughts on OJ and then Anatomy of Fall, which is a movie that I required you to watch and then forgot that I required you to watch until you told me yesterday that you had watched it. And so we'll get to Anatomy of Fall in a bit, but when OJ died, I had many thoughts, Jim. I read the long couple of obituaries about his life. And I'm going to stick to the legal strategy employed by the OJ team, Johnny Cochran, who was a brilliant trial lawyer, and obviously it resulted in acquittal. And I believe that Donald Trump is playing from the OJ playbook. The Johnny Cochran playbook, if you will. You put the system on trial and you make the people who are trying to enforce the law, or prosecute the law, make them the defendants, if you will. And it was relatively easy for OJ's legal team to do that because, I mean, there were some god-awful, obnoxious people involved in prosecuting OJ. With Donald Trump, I'm watching him taking the same page time after time in all of his cases. So if your thoughts, you're a trial lawyer, you've faced juries many times, civil side, not criminal side, but your thoughts on the OJ legacy in terms of courtroom tactics.
Well, yeah, it's a great question. And it is certainly after the man had a dazzling college and NFL football career and then became, you know, kind of America's darling as a spokesman selling isotoner gloves. And he was in the Naked Gun movies. I don't know if he was in other movies, but that's what I remember as a kid thinking Leslie Nielsen was hilarious. And this poor guy, as OJ gets every injury known to man throughout the movie, was just charming and funny and interesting and a nice sidekick. But the bigger thing that OJ's largest impact on popular culture, on legal culture, is that his criminal trial was probably one of the most famous in American history, partly because it was on television. It was O.J. Simpson. It was also Los Angeles. So it was right in the heart of Hollywood, television and movies. And fittingly had this very memorable cast of characters because his team, referred to as the dream team of lawyers, he had a lot of money to pay for a very expensive defense team, which we have discussed this in the past, and we're not the only ones who've discussed how that one of the aspects of this is it highlights how important having money can be to being able to defend yourself in the most effective way possible in this country. But beyond that, the players themselves were such colorful characters. I mean, Alan Dershowitz has been That was not the first introduction he had to American popular culture as a legal commentator, as a Harvard professor. But ever since then, it certainly springboarded him to even greater notoriety. And even more famous, the lead trial lawyer, the main message deliverer, was the great Johnny Cochran, the late great Johnny Cochran, one of maybe the most revered courtroom specialists that anybody could think of. You know, there's a few others in the civil and criminal world, but he's up there. He's in that pantheon. And he died too young. He probably would have done that work for another 10 or 15 years. It's a great renown that he continued doing it. And as a trial lawyer, one thing I can appreciate, and I always say this about what he did is, by the way, this is very weird. I was having a thought about this a few days ago, just driving around. The if it doesn't acquit, fit, you must acquit line. And so it's weird that this coincidence happened today. But what's special about that, it's not so much that it's catchy or that it worked. It's the reason why it worked is because it is catchy. It's pithy. It delivers the message simply. It highlights one of the most absurd, not only mistakes by the prosecution by having O.J. Simpson try this glove on in court live without any practice and having him wear a glove under it, basically setting it up for failure. But more importantly, it didn't talk down to the jurors, because sometimes if you try to be cute like that and it seems like you're pandering or talking down to them, like they wouldn't be smart enough to understand a complicated or sophisticated legal argument. If it doesn't fit, you must acquit is simple, but it's true, because this was the glove that had blood on it. And the whole time, and this is one of the critical pieces that people need to put trial work in context. Prosecutors have a very different job. They have to put all the evidence on. They have to prove their elements of their case beyond a reasonable doubt standard. But criminal defense attorneys, what they do is they're trying to punch holes in that. All they need to do is get one juror to believe that it's not proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So the jobs are very different. You can't compare them. They're not apples to apples. So the idea of highlighting this kind of thing, picking out this one thing that if the state of California has spent this entire trial telling you that the murderer was wearing this glove, and you saw Mr. Simpson try to put this glove on in court and it didn't fit, well, then that's reasonable doubt. And honestly, one thing that I think people who don't follow trials or watch trial TV things or read about them like I do might not recognize is that concept of picking out that one thing. It really is. It's a subjective concept. You can say, well, this creates reasonable doubt. You could watch a lawyer stand up there for an hour and say, well, this is reasonable doubt, and this is reasonable doubt, and this is reasonable doubt, and come away from it thinking, no, it's not. None of those things create any doubt whatsoever in my mind. I know the guy did it, and your arguments are ridiculous. So every defense attorney has to come up with something if that's the way they choose to defend that case. You know, they could do it differently, saying that there's an alibi. My guy was never there. But it's partly takes the confidence to stand up there and say that you really believe that creates reasonable doubt. But with this one, it was so powerful because images like that resonate. They stick in the jurors' minds. So after a multiple week trial, they'll still remember that image in their minds at the time of the closing arguments. And again, simple without talking down to them means that the jury is with you, as opposed to feeling like you're lecturing them or that you don't value them. And sometimes when you say cheesy things like, well, you're the voice of justice, that can be off-putting as well. So that's why he was great at it. And that's one of the reasons why it still resonates. And I did I've got my own little podcast with not quite the following of the great Ben Jarofsky show, but I did a show about talking about that and putting it in a different context and kind of talking about the messaging that was involved in it a couple months ago. It's something that we as lawyers know that everybody remembers if they're over the age of 30, at least to some degree, or maybe 35, somewhere in there. I guess like everything else, it'll fade a little bit, but even since that time, was it 1994, I want to say, I don't think there's been a lot of criminal trials of that level of notoriety that were on television and that pervaded across sports, news buffs, politics, nerds, criminal justice people and just regular news all at the same time.
Yeah. Actually, it's 95. The I just remembered that the murder took place in June of 94. Oh my god.
In 1994, right? Yeah. Houston Rockets and the New York Knicks. Yeah.
Thank you. You knew where I was going. I was watching the Rockets versus the Knicks on TV, and they preempted that for the Bronco chase. And I'm like, you're kidding me, right? But the trial itself, I think it took almost a year, whatever. It took many months, and it was 95 that the trial took. Because I had another basketball memory, Jim, my whole life is just linked to basketball, and you know that, is that I think the verdict came down in October. I read this, so that's why it's fresh in my mind, of 95. And that was just when the Bulls were starting their training camp for one of the most exciting seasons of all time. That's when they had Jordan and Pippen and Rodman together for that first 95-96 team.
You're going to love this. The reason why I know for sure that it was 95 is because that's when I began high school. And I was in our lunchroom, I think, when I heard the news. Oh God. And so I know I wasn't in. I'm sorry, I had to do that to you.
So young. You began high school. I was already a grown man, old man with a mortgage. And I had kids in high school. No, I didn't have kids in high school, but whatever.
Sorry, I had to.
That's all right. But I remember having a conversation with the mailman saying, oh, we're talking about OJ. And then somehow or other, immediately we went on to the Bulls. All right, forget OJ. What about Rodman? And so everything is basketball. All right. So you went to law school post Johnny Cochran.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. 10 years or so after that trial was done.
Yeah. So, so my question is Johnny Cochran's, courtroom performance, I guess, studied in law school, or do they not teach actual trial tactics in law school like that? Is it just more just memorizing what's in a book, what's on statutes, etc., and so forth?
If you choose to take a trial advocacy class, then you will learn some of that stuff. And the way they did it at DePaul in the early 2000s was, we had practitioners. We had who at the time, I think he may have since retired, but Justice Stuart Palmer was an appellate court justice for the last few years. He was a circuit court judge in Cook County at the time, was actually one of the professors for the class that I was in. And there was a practitioner, Brian, oh man, I wish I could remember it now. But he was like, he did criminal defense work. So they were teaching you practical things, but it included some of that flair. You know, if you were, or not, and not just for juries, appeal to a jury and to message to them, but giving you ideas and pointers of, okay, now you're defending someone on a preliminary hearing for a motion to suppress evidence, and you're going to stand up there and you're going to ask this cop, you know, what was the exigent circumstance that you're using to justify the search of this premises? And they'd kind of whack you over the head verbally if you were asking questions in a way that wouldn't make any sense or wouldn't be relevant or wouldn't get to the point. Hey guys, the judge hears 100 of these a day. So you need to really get to the point, point out where the holes are in that search warrant or where they, you know, whatever they found was outside the scope of the warrant or whatever the issue was. And then we would progress to, okay, now you're putting on an expert witness in front of a jury. Turn around. They have to see your face. You can't be standing with your back to the jury. You know, little things like that. And occasionally in those sorts of lessons, you might have something peppered in there about the glove, about the, you know, whether or not it fits a line like that, you know, so that's, it's, I guess maybe what I'm saying is it became part of just an easy way to connect to someone that you're teaching about this, because you can explain it just by using that example. They know what you're talking about. They know that you're talking about delivering a message in a pithy way that's straight, that's simple, and remember something that they will remember and take back with them. Mm-hmm. So I'm sure it was referenced. If I can't remember, there wasn't necessarily a specific lesson explaining it, but people knew what it was at the time.
All right. So before I tie the strategies of Cochran to the strategies of Trump, I have to ask you this. You said it was the big mistake by the prosecutors to have Simpson try to put the glove on. Go into that a little more. Like, how could they have avoided it? I mean, if they didn't do it, wouldn't the defense have done it?
Well, that's a great question. Remember, again, this is always about contextualizing what each side is doing, which would this could be a good segue, or when you're ready for it, to compare it to the French system of criminal justice, because the prosecutor has the obligation to prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. They didn't have to do it. And there's no element of murder in the California statutes that says the instrument that's used has to fit in the hand of the person that's accused of it. It's just, well, what really shows that he was really the guy, that he was there, that he had the opportunity, that he had the means, that he had motive is not an element of the crime, but you need to explain motive. Otherwise, jurors won't understand why they should believe somebody did something. So they never even had to do it. They could have tried, and this could have been one of the challenges. They could have asked to have some sort of trial run beforehand, but the judge might have denied it because there's not. It could fit under a Fifth Amendment protection that the defendant doesn't have to speak one way or the other in order to aid the prosecution, and maybe providing his body in some way could be construed as some sort of speech. Pardon me. So they could have attempted to try it out and find out if it actually fit first. But this then falls into the category of, why would you try something live when you don't actually know if it's going to work? Because this is purely demonstrative evidence at that point. I mean, it's substantive evidence in the sense that if it fit on his hand, well, there you go. But then you have to, this is why lawyers sit around and talk about these things sometimes a lot to do trial strategy. If it fit, would that really have proved that it was him? I mean, you know, gloves are gloves. How big is his hand? The jurors aren't all necessarily going to fit their hands onto his and get a sense for it. They probably assume that they're large because he's an athlete and a football player, but it in of itself wouldn't necessarily have actually proved the point. So the cost-benefit analysis as a trial lawyer should have included, how much can we actually get from this? Is it necessary to prove our case? And what's the potential downside? And if we have that potential downside, like, I don't know, it doesn't fit, how bad could that be for our case? And it turned out to be devastating. I don't remember if those jurors wrote biographies afterwards or talked about the rationale for why they found in his favor, but I got to assume for almost all of them, if not all of them, that was either the central or one of the central pillars for why they found that they just couldn't convict him of the murder.
Yeah.
Murders.
I can't recall if any jurors wrote any books. I know there were a ton of books written at the time, and I just kind of stayed away from them. I was not obsessed with the OJ trial, like most of America. I was more obsessed with the Bulls. But I was not obsessed with the OJ trial, but I couldn't help but following it, so I didn't take that deep dive. Vincent Bugliosi's book, which came out, I don't know, was a big bestseller, just slamming the jurors, pouring out all his rage at the jurors. In retrospect, Jim, I mean, they decided within three, I just read this, 3 hours, I think it was. Just think about the trial went on forever, and then they reached a verdict within 3 hours. I personally believe that OJ did it. I just strains credulity to believe that anybody else did it. I think my attitude about OJ's conviction is a lot like my attitude toward Trump. Everybody knows he did it. It just, the issue is whether you want to punish him or not. And so you may hate the racist system of criminal justice that existed in LA at the time. And so, no, you're going to let OJ go because it's time. LA clean up, look in the mirror, and LA clean up its act. That could be an attitude. And you could be a MAGA person and just absolutely despise everything that in your mind you equate with liberals and lefties, in which case Donald Trump's your guy, and no matter what he does, you're going to support him. So I see the same process going on in people's minds. So I'm not surprised that the jury reached decision that it did, particularly with, like I said, Mark Furman. I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah.
But remember they got him in the lie about whether he used the N-word. And so.
Well, you're pointing out why. It was an ironic choice in some ways, though. The Los Angeles County system of justice was very skewed against black defendants leading up to that time period.
That's correct.
I don't think that really includes a very rich, famous black defendant. So this was the thing where, you know, looking back at it, of course it made sense. So as a cultural concept and a way to tap into that, some of those jurors would feel like people get a raw deal in this county. Yes. Extending that to someone like O.J. Simpson is probably not really striking a blow for criminal justice and the little guy. But the general idea of attacking, especially when you have a client that they must have also felt was guilty. And they were, the deck was stacked against them, but he didn't want to plead and they were going to take a shot at trying the case. Then you got to find something. So if you're going to put the system on trial and you also happen to have people that just kind of fall into your lap, like Mark Furman, who you could find, you could dig up dirt and show him to be racially motivated in his police tactics. Okay. Now you've got another villain at trial. Human beings love stories. Stories have villains. They have heroes. And if you can find a villain, people naturally have antipathy towards that villain. They don't want to see that villain succeed. And suddenly it's distracting from the fact that the guy sitting at the defense counsel table over there in shackles was supposed to be the villain the entire time, because somebody killed Nicole Brown Simpson and someone killed Ronald Goldman, and it was probably him. So that's what ultimately would be brilliant. And I this is how you brought us into the show today, comparing it to Trump putting... In his case, I think it's also, I think it's reasonable to say he doesn't have any of that. There's no examples of over-prosecution, zealous prosecution, selective prosecution, investigators that are unreasonable in their tactics. These are all just basic business documents that the Trump organization had and kept and seems to have clearly fraudulently kept those documents. So he's attacking the judge as being partisan. And again, not with any basis. This would be the distinction between the OJ Dream Team and the Truth Social screaming machine about Judge Merchan. There's no evidence at all that he's either biased or unfair towards Trump, or biased in general, or that he has some, you know, I don't know if they have an equivalent of Injustice Watch in New York City, but I've never seen anything that he's somehow has it out for criminal defendants and he's unfair. He seems to enjoy a very robust, positive reputation in the New York criminal trial bar. So he doesn't actually have it, but again, with Trump, it doesn't matter if there's evidence, he'll just keep screaming about it. So
yes, you're absolutely correct. And it is a false equivalency, a classic false equivalency, to equate the very real villainy of the LA criminal justice system, the police department, the prosecutors, down through the years, the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, and how they treated black defendants, with the manufactured villainy of liberal America that Donald Trump has used to try to rile up MAGA. So you're absolutely correct. It's a total false equivalency. I'm just saying the basic strategy is the same.
Oh, I agree with. No, yeah. I wasn't disagreeing with you. I was just pointing out that that's the problem. Is it actually? It's empty. It's a very empty theory.
Yeah, and I would say now we'll come back to Anatomy of Fall. We'll close at that. I would say now we're going to make the transition to Donald Trump. That I'm not certain it'll work with Trump. Follow me on this. Maybe if his trials were in, I don't know, Mississippi, a very white part of Mississippi, or Alabama, a very white part of Alabama, or any MAGA land, Southern Illinois, very Maggie part of Maggie May, a very Maggie part of Southern Illinois, where they love Darren Bailey and Michael Boss. It might work there. But he's on trial in New York City, and he may eventually be on trial in Washington, D.C., if Jack Smith gets his way and the Supremes don't get to that rule in favor of Trump and on immunity. And then, of course, Florida. I'm not sure it'll work there, because do you think, Jim, you're going to find jurors in New York City and Washington who are going to be sympathetic to the notion that Donald Trump is the victim of a conspiracy or of a biased prosecution?
Well, I guess the answer to that, I understand your point. And if you were in an extremely heavy Trump district, they don't look for respectfully, I'd say this as kindly as I can, they don't seem to care about facts in the first place. But the way that this would start is you can prove at least enough suspicion about conspiracies or prosecutors that are doing something underhanded if you have some shred of how they've done something improper. The checks are signed by him. I mean, like, they're not, if the idea was that these are wire transfers and it's vague and we're not sure where they came from and the prosecution can't prove their provenance because they were sent from here to there and they didn't really prove the chain of custody that the banks, they can poke some holes in the notion that, well, someone else could have executed those wire transfers. Maybe it wasn't Trump that actually sent the money to Michael Cohen, and we don't believe Michael Cohen because he's a convicted felon and so on and so forth. Then maybe you can ascribe those. I guess what I'm trying to say is you need those problems, missteps, holes in the evidence, and then you can ascribe a nefarious motive to them. It doesn't work if you just start with they're after me because I'm me, unless the predicate part is believed, unless the people who are listening to this and who are the audience believe that, oh yeah, someone like you, they would all just come after you unfairly because you're something. I know that there's an audience who does believe that about Donald Trump. I think objectively it makes no sense, especially when, let's bring ourselves back to the real world here, as you know, normal people like you and I who try to process facts as like they actually exist need to do sometimes because it's such a bizarre time. He's been given every single benefit of the doubt procedurally. These gag orders, no criminal defendant that I know of could possibly behave the way that this person does, disparaging the judge, disparaging judge's clerks and staff members, disparaging the people of the city of New York, the people of the city of Washington, D.C., disparaging the witnesses, screaming crazy nonsense about Jack Smith, about Letitia James. He still uses these weird, creepy nicknames. I don't know what they're supposed to refer to. I try to keep my head out of that blender of MAGA land to understand what some of these references even refer to. Nobody's allowed to act like this. He's gotten away with all these things. So even for those people who think that somehow he's comparable to Nelson Mandela or Jesus, oh, I'm sorry, that's him who compares himself to Nelson Mandela and Jesus. But for anybody who thinks that somehow he's this crusader who's being unfairly prosecuted and maligned, there isn't even evidence of that. Yeah. Because to the contrary, he's given every benefit and not held accountable for anything pre-trial up to this point.
Could you imagine if OJ had behaved from his cell, his holding cell in Los Angeles, regarding his trial, the way Trump has behaved in his trial? I know there's no social media back in 1994, 95, Jim, so he couldn't have gone independently, but he could have still, you know, given interviews to reporters. He could have had his emissaries like Kardashian going out and talking to the press. His lawyers could have done it. Could you imagine if he had behaved like Trump?
I mean, I know he wouldn't have, because I think he was smart in that way. He knew how to try to manage his own image in a way that actually would be palatable to people. I think Trump thinks whatever he's doing is managing his image. But no, I mean, it would have turned anybody who was willing to give him any benefit of the doubt completely off. And in an environment where that trial was conducted so publicly, who knows? Maybe that would have convicted him, because people would have thought, he really is a scumbag weirdo who's screaming and yelling about things. You know, if he was disparaging the Goldman family for being front and center, that's like something Trump would have done. Yes. If it was him that was up for that, he wouldn't have liked the fact that Mr. Goldman's father was so prominent in the media demanding justice for his son. He wouldn't have liked anything else. And, you know, why are they interviewing the Brown family? Those people are always treated me terribly. If he had done any of those things, it couldn't have gone. I don't think it would have helped his case and possibly could have changed the outcome of his trial. But I think he was, I think he knew better than to do that. I mean, part of what I remember reading about at some point was he cultivated relationships with the Los Angeles police and with other powerful people because he knew that that was in his favor. Trump does that, but then as soon as someone doesn't suck up to him enough, he screams and yells about them and insults them. It's, flattery until you don't demonstrate sufficient loyalty, and then it's just burns every bridge.
Oh my God, I guess you're right. I just said that when you went on that riff, I was thinking OJ, if he behaved like Trump, would be ripping Judge Ito and ripping Christopher Darden. Oh, it just, it would, oh my goodness, what a circus it would have been had OJ behaved like Donald Trump. Wow. All right. The other thing I've thought about OJ Simpson before, and its applicability to Donald Trump, is that I think that the one sort of takeaway that people had from OJ that has sort of not been proven over time is that jurors won't, they won't convict a celebrity. And the guy that I think really tried to emulate that, the OJ tactics, on this front was Blago. Now, you were already in law school, I think, for Blago. So you, or maybe not. Maybe you were not. No, if you were in high school for OJ, you were in law school for Blago.
Okay, I'll make you feel a little better. I was already an attorney the morning that they announced his arrest.
Okay,
I was out at the Bridgeview Courthouse to do some kind of thing. I just remember getting in my car and listening to the radio and hearing about it.
So I, when I think of Blago's strategy, I think Trump took a page from Blago. Trump has taken from Blago and Johnny Cochran. But the Blago strategy was to go public. But remember, he went on talk shows and he went on entertainment talk shows like David Letterman, Geraldo Rivera. I believe his strategy is like, if I'm well known and liked, and people see me hobnobbing with David Letterman or another celebrity, then they'll think, oh, he didn't do anything wrong. Obviously, in his case, it didn't work. Not only was he convicted, but he got a very severe penalty from the judge, very severe sentencing. So talk a little bit about the strategy that Blago followed and the notion that jurors will not punish a celebrity.
Well, you know, in Rod Blagojevich's situation, the similarities between him and Donald Trump are actually pretty deep. They're much deeper than you might appreciate at first blush. And the irony, of course, is that he, at one point in time, appeared on Trump's old show. His sentence, which I think I tend to, in hindsight, I understand your point and actually agree that it probably was too harsh. We might have had that conversation on this show at one point. Trump was the guy who commuted it. Didn't pardon him, but commuted the sentence and let him out of prison. Which is very strange that these two interacted in that way after all is said and done. And also, as we recall, he's a Trumpocrat. Or I don't know if he still is, but he was for a while there. I remember that drop on your show. Trumpocrat, that's right. Somebody's in the audience is ready to just echoing everything that Rod Blagojevich was saying.
Dr. D, love that bit. He was playing Dennis loved that. Go ahead, yeah.
So, you know, his problem was in his life, his charisma, unlike Trump's, is more of a bizarre, weird charisma. Rod Blagojevich was a popular guy. And up until the point where something wouldn't go his way, he basically depended upon charm to do almost everything. You know, he got into the House of Representatives. He got into these other positions, eventually made himself governor. Probably could have eventually run for president credibly at some point. He would have been coming from Illinois. He had a whole political backing behind him until everybody realized that it was built on a house of cards. I mean, ultimately, it was the rampant corruption that tore it all down, because he was doing pay-to-play politics from basically the day he got sworn in as governor. Actually, there's a really, for you podcast listeners out there, can I promote some other podcast that's not this show? There's a really good group called Wondery that makes these things. There's one called American Scandal. And they've done it about a bunch of different subjects, but they recently did one about Blagojevich. And it derives from some of the books that were written by people who really followed the story at the time. So I was actually just thinking about this very recently because I just listened to it. It was well done. And that, in that way, his only real defense publicly was to just try to be a public figure. When he went in front of the Illinois Assembly and tried to make an argument against being impeached and removed as governor. Remember, he was actually removed by the General Assembly from the governor's office. He kind of just went up there and winged it. and I think still believed, at least according to the way the authors put this thing together, was he still believed that he could just charm everybody into thinking it wasn't so bad. But finally, it all just caught up to him because the evidence was so just enormous. The Tony Rezko connection, the receipts were there for who was paying who to get positions within Illinois government. And, you know, they consolidated all the different where the money was going into the governor's office. And basically that was a way to funnel all the money through his office. So his criminal defense basically just tried to attack all those other witnesses. As I recall, was it Stuart Levine and Rezko had already been convicted. Levine, I think, testified on behalf of the prosecution in exchange for a reduced sentence. His brother got roped into it, if I recall. And ultimately they dropped the charges against him, but it was just it was an airtight case. It was very clear what he had done, the money that he'd solicited or actually received from people. So the best that they could do was try to attack the witness's credibility and try to say, wait, you know, these are also, these people were the ones taking the money and Rod didn't know anything about it. Because there wasn't any way to pretend like it didn't happen. So the general idea that I will somehow skate through this, I think that's what Blagojevich believed all the way up until they delivered him to that prison in Colorado. That's where we're at with Trump at this point. He's tried 15 different wacky, out-of-the-blue, things that normal lawyers would never do just in the past week to try to delay this trial. Yeah. And they keep getting chopped up by the appellate court or by the trial judge. And, you know, I think I texted you yesterday or before we had breakfast, like, all right, we're counting it down now. It's like we're down to two or three business days because I'll make a prediction on this show and I might be right about this. Between now and Monday, he's going to fire at least one, if not all of his lawyers as a last minute attempt to try to delay the trial because it's one of the few levers that you have left to pull if you're, you know, if the freight train's about to crash into the station and you're starting on Monday, I don't think it's going to work. The judge can say your motion's denied. If you want to defend this case pro se, that's fine. But your counsel's going to sit there right next to you, or however they handle it in New York. But I would not be something like that or exactly that is going to happen between now. Look, he's got 72 hours or something left to stew over this, and he knows. Even in the fog of whatever's going on in his brain at this point, he knows that the evidence is bad.
All right, so let's get to it. I wrote this down because I'm going to hold you to this one. Well, it's not a bet, it's a prediction. All right, so let me get this straight. I really want to get this straight, get this down. So today is Thursday. The hush money trial in New York City starts on Monday. And your prediction, Jim, is that sometime between our recording of the show, it may have actually already happened, and I just haven't looked at my phone, and Monday's start of the trial, Donald Trump will fire all or at least one of his lawyers. And I can't remember who they are in the hush, but he's got so many lawyers. In order, oh my God, what a move. In order to delay the trial start further, because then he would have to hire another lawyer. That's your prediction?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Wow. I got to laugh. What a cynical move. If I thought the move is a pitch to both sides of the war in Gaza was cynical, then this is right up there with this. I don't think this is quite as cynical as that, because that's like really evil cynical. But this is, wow. Dastardly. I don't think it'll work if it does try that, Jim. I agree with you. I don't think the judge will allow it. But what a spectacle that would be. All right, let's talk a little bit about this trial. So one of the first conversations that Jim and I had back in the old days at that certain radio station that I can't remember was about Michael Cohen, hush money to Stormy Daniels. And here we are, Jim. It is 7 years later. Just let's pause and think about that. And Donald Trump is finally facing justice on that. So why don't you do a brief summary of that case, and we'll take it from there. Go ahead.
Yeah. So this, I want to point out the context, just like we did recently discussing the civil fraud trial. that it's not a victimless crime, that that's a serious thing. It distorts the marketplace. It takes away from other borrowers. Here, I'm sure that part of the public messaging from Trump and his people in the RNC has been, who cares about this? It's what, business records? We're talking about business records. I'm kind of paraphrasing Allen Iverson there. So, you know, it would be, it's possible that someone could buy that and think, well, what's the consequence here? What difference does it make? So he classifies it as a legal expense versus a campaign contribution or a, I don't know, it's more like a settlement in exchange for silence kind of thing. Because ultimately the purpose of the money was so that Stephanie Clifford, Stormy Daniels would not talk publicly about the alleged sexual relations that they had, which occurred shortly after Donald Trump's youngest son was born, allegedly. He denies it. She says it happened. The money exchanged hands. There was a series of payments to Michael Cohen, who at the time was still working for Trump as his lawyer, and as people have referred to him, as his fixer, as his bagman, because regardless of whatever legal acumen that he brought to the organization, he was an enforcer in the, I assume, non-physical sense, going around talking to people who might have information to keep them quiet, going around and trying to encourage people to do whatever that they were supposed to do when they had made some kind of promise to Trump or his company. And he very prominently has bragged about that role. So I'm not talking out of school here about Cohen's role. So there are records of all these payments that are made to Cohen. And it is not hard to imagine that if you have regular flow of cash to a lawyer, it could be for all kinds of purposes, but you might get in the habit of characterizing them as legal expenses, even if the real purpose is to go, you know, buy somebody silence or buy somebody off who's going to otherwise file a lawsuit that might become public and unpleasant for the Trump Corporation, or buy somebody off who just left the company to get them to shut up and sign this non-disclosure agreement, NDA, which, you know, we should never forget that the man's obsessed with NDAs. Ben, do you have a lot of people in your life who are constantly getting others around them to sign non-disclosure agreements to promise not to talk about things that happen in their presence? Because if you do, you might want to reconsider whether that's a person you want to be around. That's a creepy way to behave, to be constantly trying to buy others' silence. What are you doing that you need to keep everyone quiet about it? It can't be good. If he has this weird public persona that so many people already think that he's a strange, vile, you know, mean-spirited person, what could be so bad that he needed it to be even quiet under these circumstances? So the bigger context for all this is it happened in October of 2016. The famous Access Hollywood hot mic moment where Trump is bragging to Billy Bush about grabbing women by their sensitive parts of their anatomy came out like October 9th of 2016, right? So less than a month away from the election. October is always a fraught period of time in any presidential election year because that's when those October surprises come out. Somebody drops some kind of a bombshell. Some witness comes forth and says that, oh, I had so-and-so's baby, or, oh, this guy didn't actually serve in our platoon in Vietnam, or whatever it is. And that hot mic thing, this tape, which was grotesque, and I never, from the minute I heard it, I never bought the whole BS about, oh, it's locker room talk. This is how guys talk. I don't talk to my friends that way, Ben. We brag about things and kind of razz each other, but not about assaulting women. It just, I don't find it charming. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something. Anyway, had the next shoe that would have dropped been the fact that he also had an extramarital affair, and it would have been that much more scandalous because she's, you know, on video as a performing sexual acts as an actress. Had that been the next thing to drop, it could have changed the outcome of the election because, and I'm sure the Trump people knew they probably had some chance of winning, but I'm not even sure if they believed it was possible, but whatever it was going to be, they weren't blowing the doors out. If they were going to beat Hillary Clinton, it was going to be very close. So every little margin would make a difference. Having Cohen ensure that she would be quiet was critical. And I would argue, what's that phrase that the president, the former president can't stop using? Election interference. Yes, that's the one. That would constitute election interference by depriving the voters of knowledge that they otherwise would have had she intended on making that public. You know, is she compelled to? I don't know. But if she otherwise intended to, then making this a secret. It's one thing to just ask her to please not talk about it, but getting her to buying her silence with threats about, we'll publicize something else, because he always had this relationship with the owner of the National Enquirer, David Pecker, and they would manipulate information, put out bad stories, or promise not to publish bad stories to encourage people or dissuade people to do things. He was very in tune with whether this public message would matter. Like, that's the one thing he had the real sense of. And so that's what this payment was for. Mischaracterizing it as legal expenses was a way to hide it. That's what they call fraud in the way that you keep your books. So in the state of New York, they have a criminal penalty for that. It's a Class E felony. I would point out, honestly, it is the lowest class of felony in the state of New York, but it's a felony. And in a single conviction on one count can bring with it a 4-year sentence in state prison. There's 34 counts against him. Now, I don't know that a sentence would be 34 times 4 if he got convicted on all of them. Judges can mix and match when it comes to that. They can run consecutively as opposed to concurrently, or the other way around. But either way, these would be serious crimes, because let's put it the other way. You can always use the counterfactual to point this out. Why even do it if it didn't matter? If you're going to say that this is inconsequential or, oh, whatever, then why go to the extent of hiding this as a payment for legal services? Clearly, not only did they think that the information was bad, but they went the extra step of hiding what they'd done by characterizing it as just paying Michael Cohen for his services.
Oh, my goodness. That was a great riff. And for all I don't know if he could write it off as taxes.
But you know what? You're probably right, because he... last I heard, he doesn't like to pay taxes, even if he's supposed to.
he wrote it off as taxes. I could make the argument that it's just a sign of how our civilization has continually declined. The fact that what he was paying to conceal in 2016, 8 years later, is widely known. And doesn't seem to matter to 45% of the voters. But it may matter to that sliver of independent-minded voters who could determine this election, at least in the Electoral College. All right, so that's the case against Trump. And unless something works, and I don't know how many trips he's made to the appellate court to have this trial delayed, it's going to start on Monday. I'm going to ask you to combine legal with political here. Again, if the trial starts on Monday, it means a verdict will come down before November's election, one way or the other. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
So what impact? What's your thoughts about how this will impact the election? If Donald Trump, oh my God, just imagine a guilty verdict, and then there's sentencing and etc. Take it away, Jim. Your thoughts about it. Could he possibly be in jail by September?
Yeah. So that last question goes to whether or not Judge Marchand would order him to be remanded to custody in the custody of the county jail pending an appeal. And maybe New York would send those, you know, depending on how long it takes, do they send him into the prison system? I'm not sure. But that's a determination that has to do with whether they're a flight risk, whether, you know, the nature of the crime justifies it. I think there would be criteria for it, but it's probably a somewhat subjective decision. And these are nonviolent crimes. So whether or not they have a real impact, whether they're serious crimes, I suppose that might affect that decision. But once he's convicted, you know, this is sort of like the problem that he's run into with the civil penalty against him. He can appeal, but that doesn't come without a cost. In the civil case, he had to put up that bond that is the subject of a whole separate thing. It could be fraud. I mean, goodness knows, even the guy who put it up, it's just a whole bizarre thing. I'm not even sure. I don't know if we know publicly all the details yet, whether that'll suffice. But the first question is whether he's remanded or can be free on bond during that period of time. And yes, it would be another bond. I think New York would use a money bond system. So he could be remanded to custody pending the outcome of a certain appeal of that conviction, if that's what happens. Look, it's hard to know what the American electorate is going to do with this guy, because his unpredictability and the unusual nature of his following has made polling so inarticulate in this time. It just doesn't tell us anything most of the time. But what exists out there shows that people would take it seriously that the man was convicted of a crime. Yeah. The vast majority of people who vote for him would not care. But there certainly has to be a margin of Republican voters who don't want Joe Biden to be president who would take it seriously and not just dismiss it and say, oh, this is just a New York criminal jury. Who cares what they think? They would say, wow, I can't actually pull the lever for a convicted felon.
Yeah.
I've done a lot of things in my life. I'm a Republican voter, but I can't do that. Yeah. I think that there could be some margin that it doesn't mean that they would necessarily vote for Joe Biden, yeah. But if they stay home and they live in Pennsylvania or Michigan or Wisconsin, then it would make a pretty big impact. Not to mention, I know that you've probably already talked about it since then, but with all these other things happening around the country in swing states involving abortion rights, this would be a meaningful nail in the coffin of the 2024 Trump campaign.
Yeah. We'll have plenty of time to talk about the political implications. You're right. I can't imagine. I'm not going to say I can't imagine anything anymore. Like I said, the strategy, the political strategies that each side is employing in this election, anything is possible. That's about all I can say. I'll close. Anything is possible. All right. We're running out of time, so we don't have time to take the deep dive on Jack Smith's case, on Judge Cannon. We'll come back to all this stuff, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to be bringing Jim back to the show, whether he likes it or not, in the next, definitely within a month, because there's so much going on this legal front. But let's just take one moment at the end for all... Anyone who saw Anatomy of a Fall, which was one of the movies nominated for an Oscar, we talked about it on the show a few times. I was obsessed with it, a mini obsession, as Jim knows. I love courtroom thrillers, movies, TV shows, books. I'm obsessed with Bosch. Michael Connelly, one of my favorites. So, man, Jim, you finally got around to watching it. A few thoughts on the French system of trial advocacy. I've never seen a courtroom procedure based in France, so this is my introduction to it. What a weird system. Weird in contrast to what I've come to believe as normal after all these years of watching movies and TV shows and watching actual court trials here in America. Talk a little bit about the French system of justice. Go ahead.
Yeah, and honestly, I would recommend the film. I think it was, you know, thinking about it since we talked about it yesterday, it's a movie that I think was well done because the whole purpose was to make you very uncomfortable about a very uncomfortable situation, a marriage that was very much had already fallen apart, and a character in the main character, the wife, who has all these very questionable things going on. She's having relations with a woman outside of her marriage, but her husband, does he really know about it? She claims that he knew about it. It raises all these, you know, she's a more successful writer than he is, and actually kind of appropriated one of the concepts from one of his books. Did she steal it? Was he actually okay with it? There's all these interesting questions that they remain unresolved, but the whole movie puts you kind of in the back of your seat thinking, I don't know how I feel about her. I'm not sure if she did it. And then they have the most tragic character is the son who's kind of living through this whole thing, and who discovers his father having fallen out this. Well, did he fall out the window? Did he fall off the deck? Which level did he fall off of? And was he pushed? That's what nobody really knows for sure. Even when the movie's over, you're left to wonder what really happened. But the courtroom scenes, I know that was why you introduced it to me in the first place, are fascinating and disorienting for an American viewer. Because now here's what I've come to understand. Their system is a fact-finding based system and not an adversarial system. So the theory behind American criminal justice is you have adversaries, you have the prosecution whose responsibility is both to the public, but also to press that crime and win that case. The defense's obligation is to defend their client. And the theory is that if the two sides are pulling at each other and pushing at each other and trying to introduce evidence that's either good for them or keep evidence out that they think is bad for them based upon the rules that have grown up over the years, that the truth will come through in that process, that only things that a jury should hear will come in, and therefore the outcome will be based upon information that's highly tested. The notion of evidence in criminal and civil law is it's not just rumor. It's not innuendo. It's not a document that you wonder about. It's a document that you've proven is authentic and valid. So that whatever decision the finder of fact comes to, whether it's a judge or the jury, it's based on sound information, in theory. I mean, we all, whether that's actually what always happens is very subjective. But in the French system, which we don't derive from, ours is derivative of the British system, and theirs is very similar to ours, at least in the criminal sense. It's more of a fact-finding system. There is not a jury in that court, in those courtroom scenes. The three-panel judge group is the group that is both the rulers of law and the finder of fact, and who's going to determine whether or not she's guilty. So they're listening to everything, but they're also inquiring, which is very uncommon in American courtrooms. Judges don't ask questions of, well, they don't ask questions of witnesses for the most part. There's some exceptions to that, but they definitely don't ask questions to the defendant, because clearly France does not have a Fifth Amendment protection against self-incrimination, which is one of the bedrock principles of American jurisprudence. But here's the other twist. In America, we allow the police to interrogate somebody. It's up to them to either assert that right or waive that right. I think that actually kind of fits with the American spirit of you're kind of on your own. If you want to assert this right, you're going to have to do it. There, they don't have that protection, but it means that there's some other judge besides those three that actually conducts most of the investigation. So it's more of like a public judge whose job it is to quarterback the investigation rather than it all being run through the police. So it just changes the dynamic dramatically. But then in the courtroom, you've got the witnesses talking. Now they're turning and asking the defendant questions. Yeah. The defendant's jumping in and disagreeing with something.
Yes.
And then they had this whole additional layer, which is obviously for movie making effect, where the main character, her natural, or I think she speaks German and something else and French.
Yes.
But French is her weakest language. But she's in France, so she already feels out of her element. She's living there because that's where her husband was from, which again goes to the core problems of their marriage and her resentment for him. But then they basically force her to speak French for the first half of the trial. And then finally she just asks if she can please just speak, I think, English. Like, it's not supposed to be like she's speaking German, but we're hearing English. I think she's actually speaking English in the courtroom. Just because she can't, you know, she says, this is too complicated. I can't explain it in French. And yeah. They kind of just indulge her. That may or may not be how it actually works. So that could be some movie making effect. But this haphazard, like, everybody's kind of asking questions the whole time, and there's not a lot in the way of objecting. And there's extremely prejudicial, extremely irrelevant questions talking about her sexuality. It would only come into an American trial if somehow they could prove that, I don't know, she was trying to hide the fact that she had a female relation and the husband found out about it. And that's what they were trying to show was her motive for killing the guy. Maybe then it would come in an American trial. Here, it's just all fair game. But I guess the purpose of it is they're actually framed around, we're trying to find facts from an inquisition perspective rather than two sides fighting and the facts will kind of find themselves. Right.
Absolutely. That's a really good distillation of it. And folks, if you haven't seen the movie, I urge you to go see the movie again for every reason that Jim just stated. If nothing else, it's a fascinating look into a different system of justice. And I have to say, Jim, I'll close with this. This has been on my mind a lot lately. April Prayer, you know, comes on the show from time to time, another lawyer. Mostly a criminal defense lawyer, and her advice always, this is her motto, I think it's on her card, is shut up, lawyer up.
It's on her card, and it's good advice.
So that's April's advice. Never talk to an investigator without your lawyer present. And in our system, as you said, it's kind of viewed as like almost like an admission of guilt that you did something wrong, that if you bring a lawyer in. So it's very much, the notion is that it's not an adversarial system. And when it's in a police investigation, it's a fact-finding system. And then it later becomes an adversarial situation. Well, do you need a lawyer? You know that line? Yeah, well, should I get a lawyer? Well, do you need a lawyer? You know, like having a lawyer is an admission that you're doing something wrong. This is what I'm leading up to. So I've been obsessed with this TV show, Bosch, which is based on Michael Connelly's novels. I'm not going to urge you to watch Bosch, Jim. It's a very long involved. But it's a story of L.A. detectives. And whenever one gets in trouble, and police officers in this show get in trouble in any way, they never, ever, ever, ever before fact finders without a lawyer available. Ever. Never, ever, ever. No police officer. It's either literally their lawyer or it's someone from their union representing them or it's another police officer acting as their counsel. But it's like never, ever, ever does a police officer go before another police officer in an investigation, in a fact-finding situation, just saying, oh, I don't need, if I had, do I need a lawyer? If I had a lawyer, it would make me look bad. No. So I don't believe that such a thing as a neutral fact-finding objective world exists, Jim. Anyway.
Not in the United States system of criminal justice. And who better to know the reasons why you shouldn't talk to the police without a lawyer than the guys who normally are trying to trick people
that is
who don't have a lawyer in the room into saying stuff that they shouldn't say.
Yes. So I think April was really on to something, and definitely the police officers of LA, and I'm sure in Chicago, are following her advice when they are called before fact finders.
Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. That's the key part.
Yeah. So anyway, we'll close with that. Jim, thank you so much. We had a few technical difficulties, but we survived them. Outstanding job as always, Jim. We'll bring you back real soon because the Trump trials are starting and you and I will be obsessively following. So I'm looking forward to those conversations.
Ben, it's my great pleasure. I always enjoy it. Thanks for having me on.
All right, that's the great. Oh, wait, you got to promote your podcast. Quick, go ahead.
Don't forget, when you're done listening to this show, when you're done watching Anatomy of a Fall, when you're not watching Bosch, and when you're done listening to the Blagojevich thing on Wondery, American Scandal, don't forget to tune in to Coogan Knows the Law. There's episodes already out there. I guess I'll repost my OJ episode on social media this week since it's timely. You know, for all his faults, you know, rest in peace. It's always difficult for a family, especially when it's so public, regardless of whatever good or bad he did in the world. He certainly entertained a lot of people. So I'll post that again and I'll have some new content out shortly. So stay tuned.
All right. Very good. That's Jim Coogan. Also want to thank producer Chris. He does an outstanding job. And I know Jim agrees with me when I say, hey, producer Chris, give yourself a raise, take it out of petty cash. Peace and love, everybody.
Get podcasts from today's guest just by searching Coogan Knows the Law on your favorite streaming platforms. Don't forget, you can find previous Ben Jarofsky shows, Benny J bonus interviews, columns from Benjamin, and so much more at chicagoreader.com. You can follow Ben on Instagram at Benny J Show. And don't forget to tell your friends, like, subscribe, and follow the Ben Jarofsky Show on your favorite streaming and podcasting platforms.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.